for us to focus on Revi of Lech Lecha has particular resonance. We're at a time in world history, in the history of Israel, in the history of Earth, where war is really very much on our minds. America and much of the world is threatened by forces such as ISIS and others. Israel is in the state of ceasefire after a major war in the summer, and who knows what the future holds. So the theme of war is very much in the news, very much on our minds, and that's what this Aliyah is about. This Aliyah, Revi, is the first war that is recorded in the Torah, and teaches us about war. And Soloveitchik commented that here you find Avram being swept up in this war, the war of the four kings versus the five kings, and he writes that this is the nature of the Jew. He'll always get caught up in conflicts, even if they're not his. That's the way he fits into society, and that's certainly what we find in the history of wars recently, and the wars that we are involved in on a world scale today. It's going in both directions. That whether or not it's true, so the role of Israel as being in the center of every conflict that's going on is certainly how things are portrayed, and that seems to be, to some extent, the lot, no pun intended, for the parasha of the Jew, to be at the center of world attention, and to be noticed within the context of every conflict. Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch has similar observations in his commentary to Chumash, where he notes that this is kind of destined to happen. That here you find Avram is told that, guess what, you get to inherit this land, and look how wonderful it is. You have famine in Parsha, and you have war. And he goes on to note that this is essentially what is to be expected, and especially when we talk about war, so just geographically, so here Israel is this exposed space, which is at the crossroads of Africa, Asia, and Europe. It's essentially vulnerable to everything. And it's going to be the case that it's going to be the center of all these conflicts. And that's the hashgacha, that's what's meant to be. And it brings to mind the reality that essentially we're vulnerable, and that our only hope is a nation of Torah living up to God's message, and the hope that He will protect us. And that mentality is a part of the mentality that we're supposed to have. So this reality that we're always in the context of war, until when Mashiach comes and God's message is fully realized, that's a point we'll come back to. So that's how things essentially are going to be for the Jewish people. The Rashiv Karbi Avner of Golvach, the Tzadik Levracha, had a major essay about this, which in recent years his thoughts have been published in the series of Sufas Marachos. But even earlier than that, he had published a maimer on the concept of Mochama, which focused largely on this week's parsha as emblematic of wars. And he notes that there is a pasuk in Tehillim that talks about, I forgot the exact language of the pasuk, but the pasuk talks about how Rishoyim take out their sword, Lahapil Ani Ve'Avion, and Shecht Yisharim. So Chazal say, Lahapil Ani Ve'Avion, and they're trying to kill all the poor people, etc. That's a reference to Lot. And that to try to fight off the Yisharim, that's a reference to Avram Avinu. So Shiva noted it's a striking type of drasha, because if you read the psukim, so you think, okay, these kings are fighting with each other, and Lot happened to get caught in the middle because he's living in stone, so he gets swept up in the whole story. But the implication of this drasha is if they were out to get Lot specifically, and they're out to fight Avram, and not that Avram is being pulled in to save Lot, who got caught incidentally, but that this is the whole tachlis of what's going on. So that's striking. And the Rashid went on to comment that this is, again, the nature of the world, that we have wars, but ultimately there is a purpose. And the Kodesh Baruch Hu created a world with certain tools that are necessary to bring about perfection of the world. And because inherent in humanity and inherent in God's plan for humanity is that there has to be bechira, we have to have options. So these tools can be used l'ra. So melchama essentially means that there is the ability to fight for good, that there is the ability to stand up for a value, but by its very nature, once melchama exists, so melchama can also be abused and can also be misused. And therefore, that's what happens until ultimately there is a geula. So this idea that the wars existed for their own purpose, but ultimately, providentially, they are targeting Lot and Avram, and they're bringing Avram into the story. That's all bekavana. That reflects God's ultimate plan for the world, that the existence of war is so that right can be upheld and that his message can ultimately be spread. But until that happens in a perfect way, so wars will be used l'ra, because that's the nature of Bechira, and that's what we see happening throughout the world. So we'll come back to that point a little bit. It's very worthwhile to read his essay inside. Happens to be that essay was printed many, many years ago. It's printed in its full form in the Sefer Zikaron for Goldwicht. It's called the Yikara D'Chaim. In the publicly available, widely available Asufas Marachos volumes, it's in this week's Parsha in a much shorter version. It's kedai to see, and he's got a little more there, which we'll come back to. So in any event, so the first 12 psukim, first 11 psukim or so, so I won't read them inside, take a look, but like we like we indicated about the contemporary environment, so it kind of sounds, it's like ISIS. You see the armies are joining together, and they're wreaking devastation as they're going through the land, and they're slaughtering people, and they're just doing whatever they want. Rav Soloveitchik and others emphasized that there are different mentalities here about the Amrafel group and the Stone group. Amrafel group is about his gaiva. He wants to spread his Amrafel, Chazal tell us, was Nimrod, and he wants to spread his name across the world, and he wants to increase his glory. And Stone was less motivated in war because they were more about their taivas, they were more about their luxuries, and they become lazier, but neither Hashgafa really represents an ideal here, but they found themselves in conflict with each other, and Avram is swept up in it. So if you read these first 11 psukim, it's rather dramatic. It tells you the whole story of the war and how this whole conflict took place. So when you get to Pasuk Yud Beis, so that's where it says, Avayichu es Lot, v'yas v'chusho ben achi Avram, v'yelechu, Yoshev b'stone. So they also chap Lot in the middle of this whole thing, and he was sitting there in stone. The fact that he is the nephew, or it says here the brother, the nephew, the son of the brother, the nephew of Avram is kind of placed, it sounds like it's a little bit out of order, Vayichu as Lot v'yas v'chusho ben achi Avram. So Rav Schwab has a comment here about the way the pasuk is arranged, that it's in order to make the point that Lot had strayed, as we've seen already, that Lot started off close to Avram and part of his hashkafa, and strayed away, that he had kind of drifted away from Avram's value system, and that seemed to be a function of his materialism, and that what connects him to stone is this materialistic ideal. I was just talking to my Asai Sims class yesterday about how some suggest that if you look from Noach to Lech Lecha, so you see extremes of communism and capitalism ideologies, and that the Dor HaMabul probably reflects kind of an extreme capitalist society where they were exploiting each other economically and stealing. There was a tremendous focus on the materialism, and then the Migdal Bavel Dor represents a mentality of a more communist type of environment where the individual is completely negated towards this communal effort. And then you get to Lech Lecha and you get to Stone. Stone, it seems like the pendulum has swung back towards an extreme type of capitalism. And this focus on the materialism, so that's what seems to be their element here in the war, and that's what Lot was susceptible to. So Lot becomes a part of Sodom unless a connection to Avram. So that's what Schwab suggested, what the pasuk is inserting in between Lot and Ben Achi Avram, is this phrase, "Ve'es rechusho," his property became the issue between them. So this next pasuk, so we see the contrast, because Vayavo HaPalit, so the one who escaped came, Chazal tell us that was Og, Vayaged LaAvram HaIvri, V'hu Shochein B'lei Mamre, Amari Achi Eshko V'Achi Aner, V'hein Bali Bris Avram. So he came to Avram HaIvri. Now Ivri, of course, we recognize this word, because this is the word that we continue to use, Ad Yom Hazeh, to identify Jewish people. And the language here isn't just that he's from the other side of the river, but as the Medrash tells us, that kol olam be'ever echad, that it's ki'ilu, everyone in the world was on one side, and he's on the other side. We find the Aver used as a divide in general in halacha, and in other contexts. So Avram is all on one side, and the whole rest of the world is on the other side. So this is the tremendous gvura of Avram that we look up to, that Avram was willing to defy the whole cultural atmosphere in which he found himself, and was willing to be this religious icon and role model. So we understand why we seize on that. Perhaps that's where we continue to have this mentality, and we have this reality, not only religiously and culturally, but we see also militarily. That's the experience that we have now, especially, unfortunately, especially if you've been reading the news this week and other reports, all the more so. Israel seems to be more isolated even from its closest friends than it ever has been. It's mamish, literally, kol olam kulo be'ever echad. The whole world is on one side, and the Jew is on the other side. But the reference here, out of all the places in the Torah, why does it mention it specifically here? Why is this the pasuk in the Torah that identifies Avram that way? So there are those who suggest, the Sefer HaMoshe has an idea like this, that Og is looking for Avram. So Chazal tell us Og had some ulterior motive. He was interested in Sarah, and he was hoping that Avram would die in war. But it also seems that he thought that Avram would be helpful, that Avram would be able to really wage a war here. So he recognized that this mentality, a person who has the inner fortitude, who has this gevura, that he can stand up against the whole world. So it's that same koach that's going to translate into his military ability as well. And again, that's what we see with modern Israel also, that this is a quality that's going to serve him well on the battlefield, and of course he's correct about that. So if you look at the next pasuk, so the next pasuk tells us, Vayishma Avram ki nishba achiv. So Avram heard, here the word is his brother, he heard that his brother was taken captive. Vayarek es chanichav yilidei veso shmona asur shloshmeos v'yidof adan. So he rallies his troops, we'll talk more about that in a second, and he launches off to war. So if you look in the Sefer Emes Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has fascinating comments over here. He says, so here you find Avram, who's ready to go out to war. He says, if Avram would ask a shaila from a posek, is he obligated to do this, or is it recommended that he do this? So he'd be told that no, that he's not obligated, maybe he's not even permitted to be machnis himself into sakana in order to save somebody else. That's at least not his obligation. But, says Rabbi Yaakov, Avram is living his life based on yosher. Right? We know that Chazal tell us that the avos were called yesharim. You're probably familiar with the famous Hakdama of the Netziv to Sefer Bereishis, where he talks about this idea that the avos were yesharim, Avram is yashar. So therefore, he says, based on that, Avram felt responsible for Lot, because here Lot's father had died in the Kibshan Shalesh, and Avram accepted responsibility for him. So therefore, he felt this achrayah, so he felt he has to step in and he has to do something. And Rabbi Yaakov goes on there to talk about this concept of yashrus, and he says, this is what the avos teach us through the actions. He says, that's pshat in the pasuk, and say for Shmos, the pasuk says, v'yetnu l'chaz lufos ha'evin ha'torah v'ha'mitzvah. So Jews were given the mitzvah, that's included in the word mitzvah, the commandments of the Torah. So what's the word Torah separate from the mitzvah? So he writes, the Torah is the stories of the avos that we are given as horah, we're given as instruction, that we should know how to behave, how to be yishar. So then he goes on to say also, he thinks that that's relevant to the famous first Rashi in Chumash, first Rashi in Breishis. When Rashi asks the question, why is it that the Torah starts with Breishis, if the Torah is a book of laws, so why do we have Breishis at the beginning? So Rashi famously says that this is to show that we are entitled to Eretz Yisrael because God created the world, and he has the right to give it to whoever he wants. But that only explains the opening psukim. It doesn't explain why we have the whole rest of Sefer Breishis and the beginning of Shmos up to Parshas Bo before we get to any mitzvos. So Rabbi Yaakov says, but now we understand, because the behavior of the avos is also a part of our mitzvos. That's a part of our instruction, how to behave. That's this quality of yashrus. We say, derech eretz kadma la Torah, that before we get involved with the mitzvos, we need first the derech eretz, and the avos taught us the derech eretz. Just to comment, in that Sefer Emes Yaakov, so the footnotes, written by his grandson, so he has a point there, which I wonder if that's the only way to read it. So then he goes on to say, he says he thinks what Rav Yaakov meant in that comment is to flesh out what Rashi said, that the story of creation is necessary in order to show that we are entitled to the land. So what's the rest of it for us? He says the rest of it is to show that we behaved biyashrus even before the Torah was given, and that's why God gave us the land. That's all part of that whole answer. I'm not sure if that's what Rav Yaakov is necessarily saying. He could be saying that, okay, the first psukim are there to tell us God owns the world, and the rest of Sefer Bereishis is also a part of the mitzvahs of the Torah in order to teach us how to behave. I don't know if you necessarily have to put the two points together and say that he's saying, and that's why we're entitled to the land. But okay, either way, he's saying that that's why we need these psukim, why we need Sefer Bereishis in its totality in order to convey this message. Hi.
Yes.
Okay. So again, two pshatim of what Rav Yaakov says. So we'll also just mention here, we'll cheat a little bit by looking into Chamishi. Chamishi has the pasuk that's very, very commented on, so we'll have to leave it for next year because it's out of our jurisdiction for today. But I'll just mention it because it's relevant to this point and also because it connects to Daf Yomi. So we'll bring it in, that when Avram says that he's not going to accept any of the booty, any of the loot, so he says, "Afilu michut v'yad tzrochnal," right? I'm not interested in a shoelace, I'm not interested in a thread. So Chazal have a comment there that Avram, because he said that, so he merited to have mitzvos that were given to his descendants. So the Gemara in Sota has one interpretation, but the Medrash says that that's the mitzvah of Yibum v'chalitza, that he's given this mitzvah to his descendants of the mitzvah of Yibum, that one should marry his sister-in-law. If Rahman al-Islam, the brother, dies without any children, so one should marry his sister-in-law. And if not that, then chalitza. So the Maram Shik was a great Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, the Maram Shik on that pasuk in the next Aliyah. So he comments on what the connection is. What does that mean? That here you find Avram makes the statement, and because of that, he gets Yibum Chalitza. He gets Mesachas Yivam, this is Daf Yomi now, so it's important to mention it here. So this is the whole idea of Yibum Chalitza, right? This whole mitzvah of Yibum, what's it there for? So Maram Shik writes, he quotes from his Rabbi Chasam Sofer, that there are three major values that are represented in the mitzvah of Yibum. That on the one hand, that you see this great desire that a person has to pass on the tradition to future generations. That's the first premise. And the second premise is that if somebody is not able to do that, if he doesn't end up with that opportunity, so those who are closely related, they have an obligation to step in and to help and to try to fix that problem on behalf of their relative who doesn't have the opportunity. And the third point is that that has to be done completely lishma. So the Gemara's in Yevamos tell us the opinion of Avashol that the Yibum has to be done completely lishma. You can't have other motives, and that's why in Ashkenazi circles at least you don't find Yibum being performed too much nowadays, because we assume that people have other motivations. So in any event, so these are the values that you see represented in Yibum v'chalitza. So said the Maram Shik, that that's what Avram represented. That at least to focus on those last two points, that Avram is the one who was ready to stand up for his relative, that here Lot is in trouble. So Avram puts his own life at risk to come save him. He recognizes the same basic obligation that one has to his closest relatives. And he has the same purity of motive that when he could have profited, he says, I'm not interested in profiting at all. I don't want even a shoelace. I don't want anything connected to that. So that attitude is what is represented by the mitzvah of Yibum and Chalitza, which use a shoe. That's the textual reference. So this mitzvah of Yibum and Chalitza represents this attitude that Avram is representing here. So it's the same point that Rabbi Yaakov called the Yashrus, the special connection that he felt because he was responsible, because he was related, whatever you focus on. So he felt he had to get up and make a difference. That's the same quality. So it's interesting, this part of the pasuk that we saw, Vayarek es chanichav, so how exactly you translate that? That's a bit of a discussion. So many translated that chanichav are his trained servants, like they call in camps, right? The counselor has chanichim. So he trained his people, and he armed them. That's what it sounds like it means. But Chazal have drushes on this pasuk. It also could sound like it comes from the language of rake, to empty out, or it could sound like it means something else. So there are what seem to be conflicting drashos in the Gemara Maseches Nedarim on Daf Lamed Beis, which one could suggest seems to be the whole machlokas about Hesder and the propriety of Hesder and about yeshiva students being involved in Mulchama. That here, these were his Talmidim, these were the Talmidei Chachamim, so one of the drashos in the Gemara Nedarim is that Avram is punished, that his descendants end up enslaved, and Chazal say, this opinion the Gemara says, because he was Mevatalim from Talmud Torah. But on the other hand, all the other implications is that Avram did the right thing, and you also find a suggestion that Vayarek es Chanichav, that he armed them with the Torah, that he inspired them with Divrei Torah to get up and take on this tremendous mission of Hatzalas Nefashos. So is that a machlokas? Is that a stira? So the Reshiva of Goldberg talks about this as well in the next piece in Lech Lecha, and it's very much a companion piece to the previous piece about the Mochamos. So he says that clearly Avram did what had to be done. This is a step towards the Geula, right? We know that the Mashiach is going to come from Rus, who comes from Moab, who comes from Lot. So Lot has to be rescued in order to give birth to the Mashiach. This is all a step in terms of bringing about the Geula. This is all a necessary part for the viability of the Jewish mission. So certainly he's doing the right thing. But the suggestion of the Bittul Torah is that perhaps there's some type of a criticism here that if the Torah of Ram and his Talmidim had been perfect, had been able to accomplish bringing the world to a redeemed state on its own, so you wouldn't need to have to go through this process of war. So yes, when that's what's going on, so you have to respond. But if there was a more perfect realization of God's message in the world through their Torah study, so then we wouldn't need that. And that's what this comment reflects. And this actually is Lashitaso, and I remember hearing this from him. This represents the Rosh Yeshiva's attitude in Karen Biavna. It's Hezdi Yeshiva, is the first Hezdi Yeshiva. So the Rosh Yeshiva is sometimes criticized because he was described as subscribing to the Hashgafa of the Hezdi Yeshiva B'dievet, as opposed to L'Chachila, and his response always was, what do you mean L'Chachila? I mean, the whole war is B'dievet. You know, ideally we wouldn't have wars, so clearly the whole situation is B'dievet, so he participates, but ideally there shouldn't be a need for a war. So this is what's brought there in the Sefer as well, that he's saying that in a perfect world, we'd have a situation where nobody would be going to war, and certainly the Talmidei Chachamim wouldn't be going to war. But because we find ourselves in a matzav where this is what we need to do to survive, so then we respond, and that's perhaps what both drushes are saying. And just to finish the point, there are those who also explain the Gemara Megillah like this, because there's a Gemara Megillah, and the pasuk says in the end of the Megillah that Mordechai was ratzoi l'rov echav, that Mordechai was admired by most of his brothers, and it suggests not all of his brothers, right? That's what we're talking about yesterday, that we're talking about recently, that Rov implies that there's also a Miut, right? So Rov Echad means that there were some of his brothers who did not appreciate him. So the Gemara says that Parash met a mix of Sanhedrin, that some of the Sanhedrin separated from him because they were mad at him for his Bittul Torah. So the question comes up, what, are you supposed to let Klal Yisrael get destroyed? That was really what you think is the appropriate path? Could you really think that Mordechai did the wrong thing? So some explain, I think Rav Gedalia Shor has a piece about this in a sefer, or Rav Gedalia, that the statement is not that he made the wrong call in the moment, but that the Bittul Torah is reflected in the fact that the situation got that far, that maybe if he'd been Zoche, then there wouldn't have been the situation in the first place once the situation came up. So yeah, of course, that's what he had to do. But Bittul Torah reflects the problem in the first place. All right?
So according to Rav Goldberg, in this explanation, Hezer is a bidyabit. It's l'chachila in a bidyabit situation.
Right, the whole situation is bidyabit.
So it's not saying that Hezer is bidyabit.
Well, he is, and he's saying the need for it is bidyabit. He's saying that it's like pikuach nefesh on Shabbos, that you're going to respond when it's a situation. But, you know, it depends what you mean by Hezer, but he's saying he was essentially responding to, you know, those who say, you know, if he doesn't show any great enthusiasm for the army, so he's saying in a Hanami, right? I mean, that we'd rather not be fighting in the first place. But once there is a situation, so there is a need to fight for survival, so we'll participate in that. But he's not going to be excited as if this is what, not that others are, you know, clearly, you know, it's hard to imagine really much of a machlokus on this. He was just explaining his own attitude, that the whole institution of the war is a reflection of the B'dievet circumstance. So that trickles down into the situation and its response to being a B'dievet as well. Okay, so it's interesting, also this next pasuk. So he fights them off. So it says, V'yichalik aleihem laila hu v'yavada v'yakein. But your defame at Chova, Hashem is smaller than Mesek. Again, it's very dramatic Aliyah. You see all this war and this very heroic action. So, since in the Sefer Otzei Pelea Torah, so he points out that the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that he threw dirt at the armies and it turned into arrows. So, is this a magic dirt? Is this miraculous dirt? So, he suggests a little bit more rationalistically that this is the power of the Koach HaDimyon, that he was so intimidating in what he was doing that they perceived the dirt that he was throwing as arrows, and therefore they succumbed, they fell to him because of his intimidating presence. Okay. So in any event, so to continue, so we see that what happens after this, Vayetze Melech Stom L'Krosso, Achrei Shuvo Mehakoses Kedar LaOmer VeYasam Malachem Asher Ito El Emek Shavei Hu Emek Hamalach. So the king of stone came out to meet him after he successfully fought off Kedar LaOmer and his allies to Emek Shavei, which is the Emek Hamalach. Umalki Tzedek Melech Shalem Hotzi Lechem VeYayin VeHu Chovim LeEl Elyon. So here again, so it's interesting to have that same kind of structure that we had before. We mentioned about Lot, where his status, his title is separated from his name. So you have that here also, that here, Malki Tzedek, Melech Shalem, Bahu Kohen, Mel Elyon. In the middle, you see Hotzi Lechem V'Yayin. So in the Sefer Paris Yosef, he has a discussion there about a comment that was made by Rav Shlomo Kluger, that when you have two tzaddikim who meet, so they're both tzaddikim, but they each have a different point of emphasis or a different specialty, so they try to learn from each other. So here you have Malki Tzedek, who was Shem, meeting up with Avram. So Malki Tzedek was the Kohen, he was the specialty, his specialty was Avoda, and Avram, so his specialty is Chesed. So they each try to learn from each other. So Malki Tzedek learns from Avram to engage in chesed. That's what he emphasizes now. And we'll see that Avram is engaging in more avoda type activities, that each one is trying to strengthen themselves with the special midah of the other one. So he is a Kohen El Elyon, and he gives a bracha, is a berecheyu v'yomar, baruch Avram le'el Elyon, kone shamayim v'aretz. The end of this phrase, Kone Shemayim V'aretz, by the way, is also part of the whole discussion about HaKadosh Baruch Hu being the owner of the world. He made the kinyan and the creation of the world. that's itself a whole discussion, that what exactly that represents. If you look with Nassim Gishtet and Ernest Sefer on Chumash, has a long piece about this, but that's also relevant to that first Rashi we were saying before. So God created the world, so he owns it, so to speak. So Chitzedek gives him this bracha that he is blessed, Le Kel Elyon. So you might have thought it should have said, Me Kel Elyon, I'll give you blessings from God, blessings to God. So Soloveitchik commented that this is meant to represent that Avram is being given a bracha, that he's the source of Kiddush Hashem in the world, and that he should continue to be a source of bringing glory to God's name. So the bracha is that he should be able to do more of what he's doing, which will be a bracha for God, not just a bracha from God, but will represent the bracha for God. And that's why he blesses Avram first, because in the next pasuk, Baruch Elyon Asher, so he blesses Avram first, and then he blesses God. So it seems like you might think that should be the other way around. Shouldn't you bless God before the human being? So the whole point is the idea of blessing God doesn't really need our brachas. The idea of blessing God is that you're seeking out Kiddush Hashem in the world. And Avram is a source of Kiddush Hashem, so that's all part of one process. That part of the bracha to God is the bracha to Avram, that he should continue to be the source of Kiddush Hashem towards humanity. So this last part of the pasuk, Vayitein lo ma'aser kol, there's a lot of discussion about this. So here he's a kohen, right? So here Avram is encountering this kohen, Melchizedek, so he gives him ma'aser. So what does that mean, he gives him ma'aser? So Rashi says, mikol asher lo, from everything he had, right? Because the psukim that we're going to see next year, in the beginning of Chamishi, right, so we see that here Avram is offered all of the rechush, all of the loot from this war, and he doesn't take it. He turns it down. So where is the Meiser coming from? So it sounds like from Rashi, the way the Maharal and Sefer Gur Aryeh expands on it, that he didn't take the loot. He had his own property, so from his own property he decided to give Meiser to Melchizedek. So the question, if he was going to do that, why didn't he do that beforehand? It's hard to believe this is the first interaction he has with the Kohen, but okay, so that's one possibility. He was giving the Meiser of everything he had. The Ramban understands it differently. The Ramban understands that it was from the loot that he gave this Meiser, and that even though he didn't want to accept it, so that was his own personal chumra, that he's not going to take it, but the Chelek Gavoa he didn't want to take away from, that if part of it should be given to Hekdesh, so he didn't want to deprive Hekdesh just because he himself was not going to take part. So this might be a machlokas, the Rambam and the Raibid, that if you look in Hilchos Malachim, in Parak Tes of Hilchos Malachim, so there is a discussion there. The Rambam talks about the Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach, and about the whole history of the development of mitzvos, and how various figures in Tanakh added on certain practices. So he says there that Avram added Shachris. So the Raivid has a statement there. He seems to be saying that why does he mention that he also gave Meiser? Right? As we see here, that he gave Meiser, so that should also be included as something that Avram added to the practice of mitzvos. So the Kesef Mishnah already explains that it's not clear that that's what was going on. It's not clear that this was a normal type of Meiser, that he was just giving him a part of the loot as a covet to him. So this seems to be a Machlokas Rishonim, probably maybe this Machlokas, the Rambam and the Ravid, was Avram giving Meiser in the traditional sense, or was he giving some portion of what was taken in this war, and it was a different type of gesture? Should it be seen in the spirit of Meiser as a whole? So there is a discussion about this in the Sefer Chavetelos HaSharon, which he discusses the question that if he's giving from the loot of the war, so it's strange because he didn't acquire it. He turned the whole thing down. So it's not as if this is actual income. You know, it's one thing to say that you don't want to you don't want to pay your income tax because you want the government to get what it's due. But if you don't take the money in the first place, if you don't take the salary, so you're not chiving an income tax. So where is he going to, and you're not really able to give it, you don't own the money. So if he's not really acquiring this property, so how and why is he giving Meiser? So there is a whole discussion there. an interesting discussion, which brings us back to this topic of war that we started off with, that Avram wasn't really sure about the legitimacy of this war. That here Avram killed people in this conflict, and he wasn't 100% sure if he had done the right thing, because he wasn't sure what exactly is the nature of this mission. Is it a mission to fight off a rodef or a pikuach nefesh, or was it a genuine mochama? And he's assuming that parameters are broader for mochama than it is for standard rodef. So this is an interesting discussion. The way the Chavetz Chaim Sasharon phrases it, I would say it a little bit differently. He was basically saying that if it was just a rodef, so then he's obligated to minimize the damage. He should only have done what's necessary to save Lot and not taken any other harmful action towards anybody else. But if it was a mulchama, so then you'd have the right to kill people in that context because of it being a mulchama. So that's one way to make the distinction. I think distinction probably is better said a little bit differently, that in a war context also, you want to keep the, and this is obviously one of the major topics of discussion in the current climate, that in a war context also, you want to keep the casualties to a minimum. You want to only do what's necessary for the purposes of the goal, which in many cases is also a rodef type goal. So you still have the same mentality that if it's possible to save with less damage, that's what you're going to do. The difference, the key difference between a rodef on an individual level and a mulchama is that there is a concept of a national entity. That when you're, if you're fighting off a rodef, so let's say, you know, a single kidnapper would grab somebody and you'd chase them in the streets of Manhattan, and in order to defeat this kidnapper, so you'd shoot through 10 innocent people in order to get to him, so that wouldn't be appropriate because the kidnapper is the rodef, the people in the middle are not the rodef, so it's a situation of Yahari Voyava, really. You don't have the right to kill those people in order who aren't involved in the redifa to save yourself or to save the other person who you're saving. So on an individual level, rodef would be limited that way. But if you're dealing on a mochama level, it means that you have a national conflict. So then the armies all become a part of the national entity, and it's not looked at on the individual level. So perhaps that's the difference, that Avram wasn't sure, are we just looking at the actual redifa on Lot in an individual sense, or are we looking at the whole army that's involved, because once this is taking place, so now it's a mulchama, and it has these dinim. Parenthetically, it's a whole discussion. Coming to that?
Yeah, sorry. So the army casualties, you're saying if they're not, even if they're not actively fighting, they could be killed in war, but a rodef, other people around him would not be allowed to be.
More or less, that essentially, you know, the rodef is limited to the actual rodef. But when you deal with a national entity, so the whole army is the rodef. Yeah, however,
the army is fighting you, so why wouldn't they be considered individual rodefs?
Because they don't necessarily have to be actively fighting you right now, you know, and it's part of it. And that in a situation of a rodef, so let's say if the people in Manhattan are in your way, but they're innocent people, so you wouldn't really have any heter to hurt them, because they're not part of the effort. But here, once you have a national entity, they're all combined, and then it becomes a little bit difficult to figure out what's called a nation. You know, and that's also a point of contention today. But you can have a national entity without having a state. But and, you know, you could have a group that creates an army even without a state. You can have that type of a conflict. But that seems to be one of the differences. It's there are many differences when you talk about mulchama in general. So just to discuss one while we're talking about this, that comes up often. So, you know, the question is asked, what about the heter of pikuach nefesh, right? So one should have the active fighting is sometimes the purpose of pikuach nefesh, but why should one ever, it goes back a little bit to the heter question, or why should one ever be obligated to fight in the army? He's putting his life at risk, and what about pikuach nefesh do chesakol? So some of the Acharon are right, like the Chesinuch has a discussion that no, we don't say clearly, we don't say pikuach nefesh do chesakol in the context of mulchama, that mulchama by its very nature involves you putting your life at risk, and still mulchama exists sometimes as a mitzvah, so you have to say that that's not a part of the heter of pikuach nefesh. So that might be true, but we have to clarify what that means. You know, clearly the decisions that the army will make and that the generals will make will be geared towards saving as many lives as possible and minimizing harm to life. There's no question that pikuach nefesh factors in. It's just different than how other mitzvahs take place, where other mitzvahs, you know, Shemir Shabbos or Kashrus, if there was that level of sakana, so you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't partake in that mitzvah if there was a sakana. But when it comes to milchama, you can't say that sakana is going to get you out of it, because the whole nature is that it's predicated on sakana, but it's translated to a national level. So now you're a part of a nation, so the pikuach nefesh of the national entity becomes the priority over the pikuach nefesh of the individual. But the notion of pikuach nefesh is still relevant, and we're still clearly going to make calculations based on maximizing pikuach nefesh and minimizing death, but it's on a different scale because we're talking on a national scale rather than on an individual scale. And milchama reflects that national identity at play. So too, when dealing with this question of whether individual is a rodef or whether others are also included in it, so it goes to this question: are we dealing with a normal redifa in an individual context, or are we dealing in the context of milchama, where the definition gets broadened? So one of the other consequences, what has to do with this pasuk, so one of the, it's relevant to the whole everything, but specifically what I'm talking about in this pasuk, so what the Chavetz HaSharan suggests is that when Avram turned down the rechush, part of it was that he wasn't sure if he was entitled to it, that he's only entitled to it in the category of milchama, that if he actually conquered another army, so then part of the consequences of milchama is that you're entitled to their loot, so to speak. So if that was the case, if this was a genuine milchama, so all right, so then the property is fair game. But he wasn't 100% sure. He was misupik. Maybe this is just a din of rodef, in which case there's no heter to take their stuff. And therefore he wasn't sure if he should take it. And then when Malki Tzedek came out and he gave him this bracha from God, part of that, the message was that God was saying that what you did was right. The fact that you killed some of these other people was also legitimate because this was an act of milchama. It wasn't a more localized redifa situation. So once he saw that it was an act of milchama, that God was giving his seal of approval, so then he realized he was also entitled to the property. So then he took a maaser from the property and gave it to Malki Tzedek. Hi.
So maybe that answers what I was about to ask, which is, he says why he doesn't take the loot, which is he doesn't want to say that he got rich.
Right, so that's also part of it, right? And the question was, he, you know, was it his or was it the other king's? You know, if it's, is he going to become enriched by Melech Sdom, or is he becoming enriched because it's his? You know, did he wage this war? It's true, the psukim sound a little bit like it's talking on a different level, but this is maybe also part of the calculation. Sammy, do you have a...
Yeah, we said before that the Rav translated, he said that little kelo yom. So we see from there why maybe that could be reason why he said that he gave the Avon Rav first before the Rav. But there are like other like mainstream opinions that say that that was purposely not the right. He did give the Avon Rav first, and that's why he lost his kahuna, so the Rav wouldn't agree to that.
Yeah, that could be. I also have to confess I was combining two different comments, so that I have to put those two together. So whether one really connects to the other, I was just assuming that they seem to be related points. But you're right, it wouldn't necessarily represent all understandings of that, just like we also saw by Bayarek et Chanichav, that the Gemara suggests that Avram was punished for that, and at the same time, that Avram is rewarded for that. It's probably a couple of examples where we find these kind of nuanced things. Like we've mentioned in the past, it's a very similar vort to what we find by Moshe Rabbeinu being told to make the luchos, the second set of luchos himself. And Chazal say, "P'sal lucha, you should make the luchos, that you should know what it costs to make luchos. You shouldn't think that they're so cheap you could just throw them off a mountain, that they grow on trees. You should know the effort." So it's a funny statement because it sounds as if he's being criticized for breaking the luchos, and we know the attitude in Chazal is that yeshikach shishiparti, you did the right thing that you broke the luchos. So it's the same kind of tension that on the one hand it seems to be the right thing to do, on the other hand we find statements that seem to imply it's the wrong thing. So there the Bali Musar explained that it was the right call, but just because it's the right call doesn't mean that you're exempt from worrying about the cost, that you have to make a difficult decision between an aggressive action and something else. So sometimes this aggressive action is necessary, but it doesn't mean that you're absolved from thinking about what the cost was. So that's a very similar vort to what we've seen today, but it's also especially relevant to these concerns of Milchama, that we find that tension, and that's also a part of our balance as Jewish people, and it's part of the balance that the Israeli army at Yom HaZeh tries to reflect, that on the one hand, you have to do what's necessary in order to keep people safe and in order to fight the wars that have to be fought. And the rahmanis that we have for the consequences can't stop us from doing that, but the flip side is that the decision doesn't absolve us of the rahmanis. It's not to one or the other. That you have to contain both thoughts in your head at the same time, that just like Moshe Rabbeinu had to throw the luchos down, but also had to be sensitized to what it cost was, so too in the context of Milchama. So sometimes these aggressive actions have to be taken, and at the same time we preserve the sense of rahmanis and awareness to whatever extent we can, and that's a part of this model that the whole hashkafa of Milchama teaches us. Okay, so we'll stop the parasha here. So maybe we'll talk about what we'll do next. But so
here, question about that.